Institutions need to be student ready rather than expecting that students be college ready. Every encounter that we have with students, whether it's the financial aid office, admissions, advising, every encounter we have with students needs to be under an assumption that students may not already know the answers, the policies, the rules, and how to navigate these systems that are so foreign, especially to first generation and working class students.
Hi everyone, welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. I'm your host for the day, Danae Lenz, External Communications Coordinator for U of I, and today I'm joined by my co-host, hi Lee.
Hey Danae. I'm Lee Cooper, science writer and editor here at U of I.
How's it going today?
Oh, not too bad. We're finally getting our, second spring, first spring, fall spring.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay, so today we're going to talk about the disparities students experience in higher education. What types of things do you imagine being harder for first-generation students to navigate while attending college versus their peers whose parents also attended?
I think it comes down to basically you don't know what you don't know. I mean, first-gen aren't going to have any support if they're having trouble with classes or trouble getting into a class or trouble with dorms. They're not going to be able to, lean on that support at home. I mean, I remember simply, being in the wrong class my first year in college and, just kind of being like, well, I guess that's the way it goes. And my mom telling me, no, that's not the way it goes. Call the dean. This is who you go talk to. This is how you figure it out. And, pushing me to go do that. And, I would have never done that on my own as an 18-year-old.
Okay, so today we're going to talk to someone whose research centers around this question, basically. Her name is Krista Soria, and she is an assistant professor of leadership and counseling at University of Idaho. Her research focuses on the conditions that help students learn, thrive, and grow, and how colleges and universities can create campus climates that support students from diverse backgrounds. Today, she's going to discuss inequalities in higher education, the lasting effects of COVID on students' mental health, and what faculty members can do to help. You ready to get started?
Sounds good.
Hi, Krista. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Could you tell us a bit about who you are, what you do, and why you're so passionate about it?
I am an assistant professor in the Adult Organizational Learning and Leadership Program. That is in the Leadership and Counseling Department. I primarily teach graduate students. These are folks who typically work either in higher education, in a variety of fields, I've got students who work in law enforcement, who are working in healthcare, in nonprofit and for-profit organizations. So these are typically master's students and doctorate students who are looking to learn more about leadership, to advance in their field and in their profession. And for the doctorate students, a lot of those students are also interested in, of course, research, right? And so do a lot of research with those students as well. A lot of my background has really influenced my work and my research in higher education. I'm a first-generation working-class college student, and I came from a very rural community about 5 miles south of Canada in the northwestern corner of Minnesota. And going to college for me was definitely challenging. I had no roadmap for selecting a college, choosing a major, registering for classes, knowing how to engage, when to engage, what to do in higher education. Well, I was really lucky to attend a small liberal arts school that was really supportive to me in many different ways. I definitely always felt like an outsider, even though on the surface it probably looked like I knew what I was doing. I sort of lucked my way into becoming like a resident assistant on campus. It helped me to really get out of my shell. And also, from a very low income background, it helped me to pay for my room and board. I also worked many, many other jobs on campus, and I really centered my life on campus. So I never went home during the summers. I was a summer RA. I worked summer conferences and I took classes year round. So in hindsight, I think all of those things sort of kept me going. They were very closely affiliated with my working class identity as somebody who places a lot of great pride in having sort of a Protestant work ethic. I think that all those things helped me to graduate within 4 years. When I was a senior, I also became homecoming queen, and I attribute that to simply just being nice and friendly to everyone I knew. I certainly don't look like a homecoming queen or really act like one, if I'm being honest. But, you know, just being nice and friendly and seeing the value of interdependent relationships, which is really connected to my working class roots. Even with that honor in all the leadership positions and ways I engaged in college, I had and I still have a lot of imposter syndrome where I feel like I don't belong in higher education, that one day somebody's going to expose me as an imposter, sort of like in Scooby-Doo when the villain is revealed at the end of an episode by demasking the villain, right? I still have that perpetual fear of being found out that I don't belong in higher education because nobody in my family went to college. We're not, you know, a highly educated family. But as a white cishet woman, I can pass in higher education systems. So I can pass as though I'm middle class and as though I belong. But every day feels like a test of my abilities, my intellect, my ability to navigate the middle class culture of higher education. And so all of those factors, right, those struggles and challenges have really inspired me to develop a passion for making college more accessible and more attainable for first generation and working class college students. And first generation working class students are much less likely to enter college and graduate compared to continuing generation upper middle class students, for whom college is a birthright, right? For those students, they've always known they'll go to college. They probably have known, you know, from elementary school where they're going to go to college and what they might major in. And it was drastically different for me. When I was selecting a college, I just kind of toured two colleges and chose the one that looked a little bit nicer, but it wasn't necessarily all that quantitatively or qualitatively different from the other college. I also have a disability, which I acquired later in life. I've always been an advocate for students with disabilities. As an instructor, I've warmly accepted accommodations, gone above and beyond to support students. But my own recent experience with multiple sclerosis has really helped me to sort of level up those efforts in a way. So it's definitely infused in my research. But in the classes that I teach, I really lean into universal instructional design. I'm often the first person in a room or in a meeting to bring up what an experience or, you know, policy might be like for somebody with a disability. So MS has affected my vision. I one day just went blind in one eye very suddenly. It's compromised my immune system. So when I'm in these sessions, when we're creating materials for students, when we're talking about policies, I'm always looking for whether those courses, the materials, the research output, you know, anything that's involving students is whether those things are visually accessible, but also accommodating, especially given that, you know, the pandemic might be over, but COVID is here to stay, as I heard in a pharmacy the other day, and just recovering from COVID myself last week, right? So I'm really attuned to the experience of students with disabilities, and really my advocacy has really ramped up, I think, as a result of my own experiences too. And so those experiences, you know, rural, first generation, working class with a disability, they've led me to be really intentional about designing my courses so that I create a welcoming environment for students from a wide variety of backgrounds. I always share my background. I let students know that I too often, you know, still feel out of place in higher education, even with all my experience. And it's hard because higher education is competitive, right? There's daily rejections from publications and jobs, right? It's difficult to become faculty, even though when I went on the job market, I had over 70 peer-reviewed publications. It was difficult to get a job as a tenure track faculty. But just as an example of the way that those, you know, those factors have influenced my teaching and what I do at the U of I, when I started here, the first thing that I did is I worked with our library to get free ebooks for all of the classes in my degree program. I work with students to save other costs where we can. I'm just very forward-thinking and progressive when it comes to supporting students. My very first career, my first set of jobs in higher education were as an academic advisor and a TRIO advisor, and I take my role as an advisor very seriously. So I am proactive. I send a lot of frequent communications to let students know about opportunities, deadlines, policies, and I really try to proactively address some of their academic concerns as well.
So students can have wildly different experiences going to college and experience different outcomes, right? Can you delve into how various types of inequality can cause that disparity?
Yeah, it's hard for me to narrow it down to just one conversation, but I would share broadly that the roots of that inequality is more than just financial. It certainly has a lot of financial connections. Higher education institutions, faculty administrators, even legislators, policymakers who have a lot of influence on the field of higher education, they value a really specific type of academic, social, and cultural capital, and it tends to privilege the right kinds of students who, and I put that in quotes, right, like the right kinds of students who come from higher income, college-educated families. And so it's insufficient to just sort of like throw money at the problem in terms of the roots of these disparities, because a lot of it is just based on the capital, not just economic, that students sort of bring with them to college. Really profound structural changes are needed. For instance, some, but obviously not all institutions are really starting to change how they think about legacy admissions. And that's a system whereby the children of alumni receive priority admission. And so we kind of continually reinforce these social structures by, you know, continuing to privilege those who kind of came before, right? A lot of the inequities can be traced back to K-12 schools and how we fund school districts in the U.S. So just as a sort of an anecdote, you can bet in my small rural community, we didn't have AP classes. When I was a junior and a senior, it was the first time we received an opportunity to take one college credit from a nearby school as a part of a pilot program. Eventually, the program disappeared. It disappeared by the next academic year because our teachers didn't have master's degrees, which were required to teach the college level courses, right? So that program went away, but it was still only one college credit. So when I went to college, I had a friend who asked me, a college friend who lived in the residence hall with me, asked me, what was on your summer reading list? And I was like, okay, first, like, what is the summer reading list? Second, I was a poor kid. So the summer before I went to college, I worked every day from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. at a group home. And then I walked across our little highway, two-lane highway, to work from 4 p.m. to midnight at our town's little grocery store. You know, I had my first job when I was 13, made less than minimum wage, like $3.25. For me, working has always been a necessity. So I don't understand how somebody like me could have possibly been as academically prepared for college as my classmates who never had to work or had to work minimally, right, in high school to afford to go to college. A lot of these things are structural and they're related to how we fund our school communities and the types of resources that are available for students to help them even become prepared for college.
So what do students need to succeed and what can universities do to help?
I'll start with what can universities do, right, which I think is paramount. Institutions need to be student ready rather than expecting that students be college ready. Every encounter that we have with students, whether it's the financial aid office, admissions, advising, every encounter we have with students needs to be under an assumption that students may not already know the answers, the policies, the rules, and how to navigate these systems that are so foreign, especially to first generation and working class students. So just a really quick story. My younger sister attended college for just a few weeks. She didn't know that if she failed to attend a class on the first day that she could be dropped from the class, and that happened to her. And it was a large state institution. So she immediately felt, like day one, that she didn't belong because she was kicked out of her class. She lost financial aid. She didn't know how to navigate that system. She stopped attending by about week four or five. And she went home back to our rural small community, which has about 1,500 people. She went home, but that's where she has a sense of belonging. That's where she understands the rules, right? She fits in there. She knows what to do. Working as working class people feels very natural to us, right? So she got a job and she never went back to college because she just went right back to where it's safe, to where she feels a sense of belonging. And that's understandable. Like, who doesn't want to feel like they belong every day in their job, in their community, right? With people who know and love them back. One little slip is all that it takes to fall through the cracks in higher education. And so the question for higher ed is, what messages do we send with policies like that? We need to be more proactive at examining our data to see where these systems harm students, like dropping a student from a class if they don't attend the first day without, you know, explaining or helping them to get into another class. It's just dropped, right? That happened to my sister, and then she dropped out of college. When we change these systems, we smooth things out for students. Even at the U of I, if students are part-time graduate research assistants, they have to register for full-time classes, but their tuition reimbursement only covers half of their tuition. So what's the benefit of being a graduate research assistant if you're required to register and pay full time, but we're only going to give you half of your tuition? These are things that we need to change in our system. They're pretty easy to change, and they make a world of difference for students.
Especially with COVID and everything, and I know younger generations have just been approaching things a little bit differently than we did. So how have students' needs changed in the past few years?
First, we've had really profound changes in how we interact with the world over the last, 20 years with phones and social media. And the ways that we interact with the world, that we take in and consume news and information, they have, those changes have really altered adolescent and young people's mental health in very profound ways. We need to be prepared to work with students who have much higher rates of mental health disorders than in the past. This also bleeds into work with students with disabilities. A lot of my own research and the data that I collect suggests that up to 30 to maybe 40%, maybe even higher, percent of college students have a disability. Those mental health disorders represent the largest share of disabilities. So when we think about disabilities, right, it's no longer a learning disability. It's no longer dyslexia. We have to change even how we shape and approach our accommodations, because the largest share of students with disabilities have a disability due to their mental health disorder. We also need to attend to students' basic needs and security. Between 30 to 40% of students experience food insecurity, 60% experience housing insecurity. I don't know how we can expect students to focus and prioritize academics when they're hungry, when they're worried about paying rent. How can we expect students to study when they're working 30 to 40 hours a week to live? The higher education system is inherently flawed because we assume that throughout the whole process that students can afford to pay the same price for everything, regardless of their actual financial ability. So meal plans and housing, for instance, they are not provided with a sliding scale of affordability. We offer free and reduced lunch in K-12 systems, but we have nothing that compares, no comparative effort to free and reduced lunch in higher education. The financial situation that families are in K-12 carries over to higher ed, yet we assume that all students can afford to pay the same price regardless of their actual ability. So a few of the prominent things in my research suggest that mental health disorders and basic needs insecurity are disproportionately experienced by students from marginalized and underrepresented backgrounds. So these students are just doubly, triply disadvantaged before coming to college. And then when they're here, they experience way more hurdles compared to their peers. Things that I've done personally. So during the pandemic, I taught a lot of undergraduate and graduate classes. I quickly adapted by using trauma-informed approaches. in stressful situations like a pandemic, but just, you know, and beyond. Our window of tolerance for ambiguity, our window of tolerance for experiencing and managing even slight changes is significantly reduced. So what might have been easy to brush off prior to those stressful situations, like forgetting an assignment is due, needing to write it at the last minute, now that type of activity feels insurmountable. It feels heavy. It's stressful. So there's a few things that I've done that a lot of other faculty can easily do to alter how they organize their classes. So first, making everything accessible online. When I open a class for students, I open it several weeks before the class begins, and I have the entire class ready to go. So the class is ready, all the content, all the assignments, the syllabus, so students know what to expect at the beginning of the semester. And then it's important not to make major changes unless maybe it's to cut an assignment or cut some reading to give students a break, but no major changes to the classes. Sticking with the schedule, sticking with the structure is really useful as a means of mitigating the stress of living in and experiencing trauma. It's also important that faculty share resources on their learning management system. So, you know, I've got links for mental health resources, food security resources, sending regular communications, like every Tuesday, send an email, right? So students know what to expect. And then be proactive at encouraging students to utilize their resources. It's also important for faculty to be aware of when resources are difficult to access. So sometimes mental health counseling centers can be booked for months on end. When I worked at the University of Minnesota, our Disability Resource Center would get booked so far in advance that maybe it was week 4 or 5 of the semester, and students couldn't get an appointment with a disability resource counselor to help them get accommodations because they were already booked through the academic year. And then, of course, to make sure that students, you know, don't wait until the last minute to access those resources. I recommend being flexible with late work, not penalizing students who submit late work. You know, some faculty believe that we're training students for the real world, but students already know what the real world is like. And, you know, who among us faculty have not benefited from extensions in our personal lives, right? It's also important to create assignments that are meaningful and relevant, avoiding busy work. I just want to say, you faculty, you know who you are when you when you have busy work, right? And maybe you don't, but listen to students. I work often with adult learners, so I create project-based assignments that are relevant to their professions, career, future goals, and et cetera. And then finally, importantly, being compassionate and caring, letting students know that they belong, saying those words to them often. Here's a couple of examples of small things I've done that did not take a lot of time or money. In 2020, the first sort of Thanksgiving of the pandemic, I made students and coworkers Thanksgiving meals, and I delivered them at their dorms, their residence halls, or their homes. At one point, I purchased a laptop computer for a student. It was just $50 at a university reuse sale where they were selling back their old equipment, and it wasn't that old of a laptop, but you know, it was $50. And she was a single mom with 5 kids and was very financially oppressed. It was one small gesture that I could do to help her to be successful in academics. I make and mail our students welcome cards. I make our graduates some art. On Valentine's Day, I send my students all a message where I say, like, I love you. I love my job. I'm so grateful to work at the University of Idaho and to work alongside them. Tell your students that you're proud of them. When you tell somebody that you're proud of them, that is life-changing. That is rare. That doesn't happen a lot. And tell them they're smart. Tell them they're brilliant. Tell them that you appreciate them and let them know and feel seen and heard.
All of that sounds really cool and very different from my experience with college. And I didn't super struggle in college, but all of that would have made it much, much easier. But I imagine it's hard to get faculty to change. Like, I know what you just said, not everyone is doing, obviously. So how do you get them on board with adjusting so that they can better match the evolving needs of students?
Yeah, if there's one thing that I've found with those examples, it's that taking those really small steps has made my job easier and better. It's actually not a heavy lift, and it has made my job much more meaningful. And I wake up every day with a strong sense of purpose. I've taught literally, seriously, hundreds of individual classes and thousands of students. For any faculty who is on the fence about, you know, offering more compassion, taking these little steps to help students feel like they belong, I promise that taking those steps will help you to just fall in love with your job all over again. Students will see that you care. All it takes is sometimes just one tiny email or text message or, you know, some small gesture to convey that you see and hear students. And it's really smart to also model the way, right? Like, there are so many major things happening in society: school shootings, wars, capital insurrection, pandemic. A lot of folks lost a lot of loved ones during the pandemic and didn't have a chance to fully grieve. We're all recovering. So let's do so together and with compassion. And by modeling the way, we will create this like trickle effect of, I hope, improving humanity, right? Making folks just better humans. We're all going through this. So like, let's do so together and with compassion.
I just have one last question for you. What is the most important thing that you want people to take away from our conversation today?
If we really care about student success, we need to adapt our systems to support them. But there's also a lot that we as individuals can do to make a difference in students' lives. I argue that these steps do not need to be radical shifts. Listen to students, be compassionate, and adapt.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This conversation has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure for me. I'm very passionate about working with college students and helping them to be successful. And I'm happy to come back and share more at any other time.
Okay, Leigh, what did you think?
It's always interesting being put in other people's shoes. Because, I mean, I work on a campus, obviously, so I think about students and what they're going through all the time. That made me think about some things that I possibly haven't gotten into my consciousness, you know, kind of at all times. And I think part of college should be learning the skills you need to tackle challenges that you don't necessarily know how to tackle, and that professors and administration, we should be empathetic to the fact that there is going to be a fairly large divergence between our students who are first gen and ones who this is the fourth generation of Vandals. They're going to have a very large, different amount of knowledge about how campuses work. And I think that teaching students how to engage in their college, that should be part of the experience, absolutely. And hopefully that also teaches them some skills for later on in how to tackle the business world and how to get, you know, succeed there as well.
I definitely agree that first-gen students obviously have very different experiences. But the other thing that stood out to me in this interview was, and I guess it's not that surprising, but just how deeply COVID affected students that are going to college today. It's just like deeply generational trauma, and it affected their social lives and just all of this stuff. And that definitely deserves some empathy and maybe a little bit of a different way of approaching students these days.
Yeah, absolutely. I think COVID, I mean, affected everybody and I think each generation in quite different ways, and it's something that can't just be blown off as, oh, thank God that's over and back to normal. Like, normal's doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
Thank you for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit our website at uidaho.edu/vandaltheory for more about our research. Email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu. We're on all the podcast platforms, so rate, review, and subscribe. I'm Danae Lenz.
And I'm Leigh Cooper.
Thanks for joining us.